Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along on this cold and windy night, and it's great to have Senator Matthias Cormann for the first time at the Sydney Institute. We're very grateful to get seeing you, a cabinet minister, at so busy a time. I'll introduce him briefly. Senator Cormann was educated at the University of Notre Dame in Namur in Belgium, and then at the Catholic University at Leuven in Belgium, and then at the University of East Anglia. He obtained a law degree and other qualifications. He was a lawyer first in Belgium, then he came to Australia. He worked as a political staffer, and then he went into business and then into politics. And of course, Senator Cormann has been Senator for Western Australia since 2007. He held a number of senior positions in the coalition during the opposition years, and was quite prominent in the last election campaign, as you'll recall. But since September 2013, Matthias Cormann has been, of course, the Minister for Finance, a cabinet minister, and tonight he's going to address the Sydney Institute on Australia Needs a Fiscal Reality Check. Matthias Cormann, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gerard, and thank you so much for the invitation to speak at this prestigious institution. It is indeed my first opportunity to speak before the Sydney Institute, and I'm very grateful that so many of you have made the time to come and listen about matters fiscal and economic policy. It gives us great hope that on a night like tonight there is so much interest in how we can put Australia on a stronger economic and fiscal foundation for the future. Australia does need a reality check when it comes to the state of our budget. We need a reality check about where we are at and why, where we are headed without serious corrective action and why, and what we need to do to protect our living standards and to build a stronger, more prosperous economy where everyone has the opportunity to get ahead. So let's start first with some of the realities. The reality is that Labor delivered $191 billion in cumulative deficits in its first five budgets, and a further $123 billion in projected deficits in its last budget. The reality is that in just the few weeks between that final budget that Labor delivered in May last year and Labor's own pre-election budget update late August, the budget position deteriorated by a further $33 billion, or $3 billion a week, and it continued to deteriorate after that. The reality is that by the time we came to government, gross debt was heading for at least $667 billion within the decade, growing further beyond that period. And the reality is that when we came into government in September last year, we inherited an economy growing below trend, rising unemployment, low consumer confidence, business investment which had plateaued, and a bad and rapidly deteriorating budget position with a spending growth trajectory which was manifestly unsustainable, in particular in the period beyond the forward estimates at the time of the last election. Contrast that with the situation the previous government inherited in 2007. A strong budget and a strong economy. No government net debt. A $20 billion surplus. More than $50 billion in net Commonwealth assets. The Australian government at that time collecting more than $1 billion a year in net interest payments on the back of a positive net asset position. after Australians did the hard yards, backing a coalition government at successive elections, which was dealing with the serious and difficult fiscal challenges left behind by their Labor predecessors, the coalition was able to pursue important economic, fiscal, taxation and social policy reforms. That included successive income tax cuts, further strengthening economic opportunity, as well as improvements in government benefits for families and older Australians across Australia. But not only did Australians achieve real improvements in living standards, underpinned by stronger economic performance, that strong fiscal, economic and social policy foundation, with the federal government living within its means, stood Australia in very good stead when we faced the global economic headwinds in the context of the global financial crisis. Sadly, the reality is that we are in a much weaker fiscal position today than we were in 2007. That we are more exposed and less resilient as a nation today than we could be, should be, and can be again, to deal with any global economic challenges which may come our way in the years ahead. We are not in as strong a position as we could be, should be, and can be again to take advantage of the opportunities which will come our way in the context of strengthening economic growth across the Asia Pacific. Those are the realities we have to confront as a nation and that we must address. Incredibly, Labor appears to be in complete denial about the state of the budget they left behind and about the unsustainable spending growth trajectory the Rudd and Gillard Labor governments put Australia on. Like many Australians with family and friends in Europe, I know how painful fiscal crises are when they strike, how many jobs are lost, hopes shattered, and plans reduced to rubble. Like all of you, I have seen the human toll a fiscal crisis can impose and the political turmoil it creates, turmoil which can make problems even more intractable and the pain even more prolonged. But I say this because at times it seems as if for some the current debate about the budget is a bit like a spectator sport with a focus on how the contending teams are scoring when we're actually all in this together. I mean, this is not a game. If we fail to address the fiscal mess the previous government left behind, the crisis next time, and there will be a next time, will find us unable to support jobs, preserve vital services, and protect the disadvantaged. And the loss of confidence in Australia's ability to get its house in order would deter investment, compounding the challenge our economy faces as our terms of trade return to more normal levels. None of this is to suggest that addressing our fiscal challenges will be easy. It obviously won't be. The spending and debt growth trajectories we inherited from Labor were among the steepest in the world, taking us further and further down an unsustainable track. And don't take my word for it. The ABC fact check confirmed that that assertion by the Treasurer is correct, so it must be true. In the last year of the Howard government, spending as a share of GDP was at 23.1%. We inherited federal spending as a share of GDP in 2013-14 of 25.9%. And without any corrective action, we were heading for spending as a share of GDP of 26.5% within the decade. At the same time, tax revenue as a share of GDP sits below 22%, with an average tax to GDP ratio over the last 20 years of 22.4%, while overall government revenue as a share of GDP is at 23.6% relative to a historic average of 24.1%. So there is a large fiscal gap, which translates into mounting public debt, with that mounting debt translating into rising interest payments. As I said earlier, in 2007, when Labor came to office, the Australian government was collecting more than $1 billion a year in net interest payments on the back of a positive net asset position. Now, we are forced to pay $1 billion a month in interest payments just to service all the debt accumulated by the previous Labor government, and that number is growing every day. And that is, just to put this into context, every one of about 10 million working taxpayers across Australia has to pay about $100 in tax each and every month, or about $1,200 in tax a year, just to pay the interest on Labor's debt. And unless we take corrective action, that figure continues to go up and up. And with the US recovery putting upward pressure on world interest rates, that cost will rise even further unless we close the gap between what we spend and what we earn, and unless we start to pay off some of the debt that has been accumulated. And that gap needs to be closed by bringing down the level of federal spending growth moving forward. If we were to choose to close that gap by driving up government revenue beyond the 26.5% of spending as a share of GDP that was locked in by our predecessors within the decade, it would hurt our economy and cost jobs, putting Australians under yet more pressure. And the budget we have delivered is the first vital step in that process. It establishes a credible, economically responsible path for return to surplus. It sets out a trajectory for public expenditure that brings down spending as a share of GDP over the forward estimates and beyond on the back of genuine structural savings and reforms. And it shares the burden of the adjustments widely across the community while protecting the most vulnerable. At the same time, we recognise that there is no better way to advance fiscal sustainability than by unleashing our economy's growth potential. After all, stronger, more sustained growth not only benefits Australians directly, it also expands the tax base while reducing the pressure on social spending. Unfortunately, though, just as they were locking Australia into excessive spending, the Rudd and Gillard governments pursued policies which made it harder for the Australian economy to be successful, further hindering any efforts to bring the budget back into surplus. In the face of obviously challenging global economic conditions, instead of working to make Australia more competitive internationally and to strengthen economic growth opportunities into the future, the Rudd and Gillard Labor governments kept adding more and more lead into our saddlebag. The carbon tax, the mining tax, more than 21,000 pieces of new red and green tape, increased levels of union militancy on the back of such poor decisions as the abolition of the Australian Building and Construction Commission, were all cases in point. Together, they contributed to the increasing cost of doing business in Australia, which in turn reduced growth and ultimately resulted in lower than expected revenue for government. In simple terms, our fiscal and economic strategy is to live within our means, bringing spending growth under control while ensuring structural reforms allow us to deliver more with less. And to remove the lead Labor put into our economy saddlebags, bringing down the cost of doing business, restoring our international competitiveness, boosting jobs and expanding the long-term revenue base for government in the process. We never expected our strategy to be uncontentious. But even hardened cynics must have been somewhat surprised by Labor's reaction to our budget. After all, Labor spent the best part of 3 years lecturing us about the importance of returning the budget to surplus quickly. Remember former Treasurer Wayne Swannen, we've heard a bit of him again in recent days. Interesting book, apparently. But in his budget speech in May 2011, he said, and I'm quoting him, Meandering back to surplus would compound the pressures in our economy and push up the cost of living for pensioners and working people. A year later, he said in the doorstep at Parliament House that, and I'm quoting him again, coming back to surplus is about making sure we help those people sitting around the kitchen table when they're figuring out how they will make ends meet. All told, Wayne Swan promised to deliver a budget surplus on 366 occasions. It would seem that Wayne Swan promised a budget surplus even more frequently than he bagged former Prime Minister Rudd, though probably not by much. He never quite got to a surplus, but at least, unlike Bill Shorten, Chris Bowen and Tony Burke today, at least he understood that a return to surplus as soon as possible was important for our country, for working people, for pensioners and for people sitting around the kitchen table. Now, brushing aside the fiscal realities I mentioned at the outset, Labour simply denies that there is anything to worry about. Instead of proposing any alternatives, Labour, under Bill Shorten, seems to have just given up completely on putting Australia back on a stronger fiscal foundation for the future. Intent on preventing us from achieving the return to surplus they so often promised but were never able to secure, Labour under Bill Shorten now is even opposing $5 billion in savings initiated and banked in Labour's last budget by Julia Gillard and Kevin Rudd. Talk about putting politics ahead of the national interest. Here are some questions that I believe the media should be putting to Bill Shorten, Chris Bowen and Tony Burke every day. And to the whole Labour Party, every time they front up at the doors, these are the questions that every Labour Member of Parliament should be asked. Number one, are you still committed to a budget surplus? If so, how would you achieve it? Do you accept that a federal spending growth trajectory heading for spending of 26.5% as a share of GDP by 23-24 is unsustainable? If you do, how would you reduce spending as a share of GDP to more affordable and sustainable levels? If you do not, does that mean you would increase taxes to get there, and if so, which ones? Or would you just keep borrowing from our children and grandchildren to make up the difference between the revenue and expenditure trajectories over the medium to long term? These are the options. Time will tell whether Labour continues to put its short-term political interests ahead of the national interest. We believe that ultimately voters will judge them harshly if they do. As far as the government is concerned, we will continue to press ahead and do everything we can to repair the budget, as we said we would do in the lead-up to the last election. So where are we at in the Senate when it comes to passing the budget? There's been a lot of noise in the media about where things are at with the budget. The implied suggestion in much of the commentary seems to be that unless every last part of the budget had gone through both Houses of Parliament in full by now, we were somehow running late. That is, of course, not true. A significant part of the budget has gone through and had gone through both Houses of Parliament by the end of June. The appropriation bills were passed in full, including our single largest saving, the $7.6 billion reduction in previously budgeted federal funding growth for foreign aid over the forward estimates. Our budget repair levy has passed the Senate with Labour's support after initial suggestions that they would oppose it. Various other budget reforms and savings measures have been passed by both Houses of Parliament since. The first 2 weeks of the new Senate were always going to be dominated by the carbon tax and mining tax repeal packages. The carbon tax is gone as promised, and the mining tax repeal is work in progress. A number of the measures that are the subject of the most intensive post-budget debate are not due to take effect for some time. So there is still ample time to keep engaging with Senate crossbenchers and to properly prioritise and deal with budget measures sequentially in an orderly and methodical fashion. Situation normal, really. That is the way it is always done. No government in recent political history had passed all of its budget measures through both houses of parliament by the end of August. Not the previous government, not the government before that. We are on track, and we will continue to work with perhaps an adjustment here, an adjustment there, to fundamentally get all our budget measures through the parliament. In relation to some of the specifics, in relation to our proposed $7 co-payment for access to medical services. This proposal is not due to come into effect until 1 July 2015. Let's just put this into the context of what we're actually trying to achieve. The key policy challenge in healthcare financing is how best to ensure that all Australians can have timely and affordable access to high-quality healthcare in a way that is affordable for taxpayers over the medium and long term. How do we ensure that the necessarily limited resources of taxpayers are deployed to maximum effect to service all the genuine needs of a growing number of patients in the context of an ageing population over the next few decades? An appropriate price signal is a proven way to improve the efficiency of allocating limited resources to a growing demand for services. And under our proposed co-payment, there is a safeguard for pensioners, other concession card holders, and children under 16 years of age. And to put it in very explicit terms, and something that has surprised some of the people that we've engaged in with conversations within the parliament in recent weeks, just to make it really explicit, that under our proposal for a $7 co-payment, that no pensioner would have to pay more than $70 a year for unlimited access to medical services. That no pensioner would have to pay more than $70 a year for unlimited access to medical services. In relation to higher education reforms, we want our university sector to remain world-class and internationally competitive, which is why my colleague Christopher Pyne is leading a comprehensive higher education reform agenda. We want to foster excellence by deregulating the provision of higher education and directing public funding to where it is needed, so that the decisions of students, the needs of employers, and the initiative of our academic leaders drives the future of our higher education system. These reforms are not due to come into effect until 2016. So again, there is ample time to work through any issues. And there is nothing unfair about these reforms either. In Australia, we have a very generous and unique taxpayer-funded support system for students. I don't think there is another example of a scheme like the HELP scheme, which used to be the HEC scheme, anywhere around the world. It is a very egalitarian system which facilitates access to higher education for everyone, irrespective of their social background. That's because in Australia, anyone wanting to study at university is able to borrow 100% of the cost of that course from the taxpayer through what used to be the HEC system and what is now the HELP system. And students only have to pay back the cost of that degree once they earn above a certain income and at a discounted interest rate at that, even after the changes that we're proposing to make in this budget. So it is a pretty fair arrangement. In relation to the proposed reintroduction of the indexation of the fuel excise, since the indexation of the fuel excise was abolished in 2001, the excise as a proportion of the average pump price of fuel has fallen from about 42% to about 25% today. Reintroducing the indexation of the excise on fuel so that its real value does not keep falling with inflation is an important structural reform. It will ensure that moving forward, the value of the fuel excise will again keep pace with inflation and will help underwrite our significant additional investment in productivity-enhancing road infrastructure. It will add just 1 cent a litre to the cost of fuel in year one. And as we pursue all of those measures to repair the budget, of course, we will continue to pursue our comprehensive plan for a stronger, more prosperous economy. The carbon tax has been repealed. We are underway when it comes to repealing the mining tax. Bear with us. Conversations are ongoing, and we're hopeful that in time we'll be able to persuade and reach an agreement with enough senators represented in the Australian Senate to have the mining tax repealed. We're focused on reducing red tape costs for business by about $1 billion a year, investing in productivity-enhancing infrastructure right across Australia, pursuing improved trade opportunities across the world, generally improving our international competitiveness by reducing the cost of doing business and improving productivity, restoring the Australian Building and Construction Commission, and introducing a fair dinkum paper rental leave scheme, which will help lift female workforce participation and help us deal with one of the structural challenges that we're facing as an economy with an ageing population and falling workforce participation rates. In summary, Labor and some others have argued that our budget is unfair. I put it to you that that is nonsense. What is unfair is to promise what you cannot deliver, to hold out hopes you know will be dashed, to rob from tomorrow to live it up today, to keep borrowing from our children and grandchildren to fund our recurrent expenditure today, reducing opportunity for future generations by creating the need for either higher taxes or deeper cuts to pay for it with interest down the track. That, for the last 6 years, has been Labor's way. It is not our way. Rather, our budget makes spending sustainable over the medium to long term. That means our commitments can be delivered to older Australians who deserve a secure future, to our young people who deserve great schools and world-class tertiary education, and to working families who deserve stable, well-paid jobs and high-quality public services. And fiscal sustainability means we will be able to make good on those commitments without crippling tax burdens. Ultimately, that is the choice Australia faces. We can keep borrowing from our children and grandchildren to pay for our recurrent expenditure today, or we can start the task of a credible return to surplus. Faced with that choice, our government will not keep kicking Labor's dead and deficit can down the road. But we know that the longer we wait before getting the budget back on track and back on a credible path to surplus, the harder it will be to get there, and the greater the sacrifices will have to be. We did not set out to put together a popular budget. We set out to put together the budget Australia needs right now if we are to protect our living standards and build better opportunities for the future. We always knew that this was going to be a marathon and not a sprint. We are committed to the marathon. And in time, we're confident that people across Australia will come to accept that what we did in the budget was right and needed to be done. Thank you so much for your attention.
Minutes exactly. Right on time. Pretty impressive, actually. So thanks to Senator Cormann. We'll come to questions and discussion in a minute. A lot of people here could ask you to keep your comments or your questions brief. If I have to repeat them, it's because I think they're not being picked up on the podcast or on television. I should say before we start, many thanks to the law firm Allens for providing this terrific facility tonight in the Sydney CBD. We're very grateful for that. And so we start questions and discussion. In your topic, you spoke about fiscal reality, but as you know, you've spoken today about Labor, and I think it's probably fair to summarise Labor's position is that debt can be a problem, but not right now. But then you've got the Greens, who really say it's not a problem at all, and the Palmer United Party, we saw Mr. Palmer on television last night, who also seems to say it's not a problem at all. So how do you come across, how do you preach reality to senators and other parliamentarians who simply say that debt's not a problem?
Well, if you look at our debt position in isolation and you compare it to the debt position in other countries around the world, it is true that it is low by international standards. The problem is that ignores the fact that the only reason we're in a better position is because we had a much stronger starting position. We started with no debt, a $20 billion surplus and $50 billion of cash at the bank. The most significant problem, on top of the $314 billion in accumulated and projected deficits over the 6 years of Labour budgets, the most significant problem is the trajectory that we're on. And if you want to see where we're heading, and if you want to get a sense of our destination, the most important thing to look at is the trajectory. And I mean, trajectories can be a bit insidious because, you know, when you're on your early steps heading down in a bad direction, you might not quite notice the implications of what you're doing. And it's often when you realize that you ended up over there when you needed to be over there, it is a bit too late to make easy adjustments, and you have to make quite radical adjustments to get yourself back onto a more appropriate trajectory, which hurts. But the final point I would make, and it's really sad when you have to quote former French socialist politicians and to hold up a mirror to some of the commentators on budget and fiscal matters here in Australia. But the other day, Pascal Lamy was in Sydney, former head of the World Trade Organization, former senior French socialist politician, and he made the quite accurate observation that Australia is a commodity-based, trade-exposed economy, which is more exposed to global economic fluctuations than, I guess, some of the economies across Europe or the United States. We don't have a large domestic market, and really, in the period of the last government, yes, they had to deal with the GFC, but quite frankly, the situation in Australia was not comparable to the situation in the United States and Europe. Our cash rate was high, and there was scope for monetary policy to do a lot of the heavy lifting, even as required. And we had the best terms of trade in 140 years. And in a commodity-based economy, when your terms of trade are high, it's when you should be saving for a rainy day. Instead, of course, the government went for what we say was an excessive fiscal stimulus, which was used to fund inefficient and wasteful stimulus projects. And of course, what was the result? Immediately after the government started pushing out additional fiscal stimulus, quite unprecedented anywhere around the world in terms of any advanced economy, from September 2009 or thereabouts to about October 2010, our official cash rate went up from 3% to 4.75%, when in the US and Europe was hovering around zero for years, and quantitative easing, you name it. And at the same time as having high terms of trade, comparatively high official cash rate, low cash rate everywhere else, and quantitative easing, what happened to the value of our Australian dollar? It went up. What did that mean for our international competitiveness? It went down. So, cut a long story short, firstly, our budget is a problem, but the biggest problem is the trajectory we're on. And as I've said in my address, we are on one of the steepest spending growth, or we were when we came into government, on one of the steepest spending growth and debt growth trajectories in the world. And we don't have, as an economy, the same capacity to sustain the sort of levels of government debt that has been the experience that has been experienced in other parts of the world, and that is by virtue of the nature of our economy compared to theirs. And the only reason why we're not yet in a worse position is because we were in such a strong position, back in 2007.
There's a question over there.
Senator, thank you. I might suggest that a large number of people in this room perhaps fully understand and agree to a certain extent with everything that you've said tonight. My question, a bit brutal maybe.
Yeah, go for it.
When, as a coalition, government going to find the rhetoric and the oratory to ensure that the majority of Australians understand all these problems?
Well, sir, and thank you for that question. The reason I'm here today and tonight is part of, you know, what we're doing in that regard. I mean, the Treasurer, the Prime Minister, all coalition members and senators, and I mean, we are out there every day doing our best trying to explain what we're doing and why. But let me also say there's no easy way to say to somebody that you might have thought that payments that you thought you were received, that you were receiving from government would go up by that much, and now they're only going up by that much. As a result of all of the mismanagement over the last 6 years, you're going to have to pay a bit more tax here or accept less spending there. I mean, there is no easy way of making that immediately popular. And we never thought that it was going to be immediately popular. What we thought to do, what we sought to do, was to spread the effort as widely as possible, which Labour then has described as making enemies with just about everyone. But, well, I mean, unless you spread the burden as widely as possible, asking every part of the community to do a bit, including the states and territories and other organisations and local government and so on, unless you spread the burden across the board, if you spread the burden on fewer people, obviously the burden will necessarily be larger on those that stay behind. Now, I just make one final observation in relation to the sort of, I guess, the split between the budget repair effort when it comes to savings and measures through the tax system. Our spending growth trajectory is unsustainable. I mean, to go up to 26.5% of spending as a share of GDP is not sensible. To suggest that we can cover that level of expenditure by increasing taxes and other government revenue to that level is not sensible, because it would hurt our economy if we were trying to balance expenditure and revenue at that level through increases in revenue. Now, if you accept the proposition that the spending growth trajectory is too steep and that we need to bring down the spending growth trajectory, then there is no easy way of doing it, because at risk of stating the bleeding obvious, the only way you can reduce the spending growth trajectory is by reducing payments by government. And when you reduce payments by government, inevitably, you're going to impact on individuals, organisations, states and territories and others that receive payments from government. Now, I mean, I thought that that was a statement of the bleeding obvious, but Labour thought it was such an extraordinary revelation that they thought they would take it as a gotcha moment and run into the Parliament to suggest, oh, the Finance Minister has said that your savings measures are going to impact on individuals, organisations and the states and territories. Well, hello. I mean, of course. But this is the nature of the debate. I mean, when you're trying to have a sensible conversation, okay, well, what does it mean if we continue to spend more than we raise in revenue? Well, what it means is that we're asking our children and grandchildren to pay for our consumption today, and they will have to either pay more tax or accept deeper cuts down the track in order to cover our expenditure today. But, I mean, that is the ultimate fairness question, really. But does that mean it makes it easy to convince people to accept lower spending? So far, it's a work in progress.
There's a question there. Yeah. Behind. Yes.
Thank you for coming along to speak to us. The question I have is about the fairness point. I think many people will agree with the proposition that we want to pay off debt. It's the manner in which the government wants to do that, I think, which is causing a lot of concern for many people and making the budget very unpopular.
How would you do it?
Well, parental leave scheme.
So you think that would help us balance the books?
Well, I think there are a range of ways that you can do it, and that a lot of people have concern about the manner in which you're choosing to do it, and I would like to see more debate about alternative options.
Yeah. Well, let me just, I mean, I guess start with the paid parental leave scheme first, because, I mean, it is an issue, obviously, that gets raised with us. We do face a series of economic challenges as a nation, and, one is the ageing of the population, which does lead to falling workforce participation levels, and the other is our reliance on terms of trade and falling terms of trade, and how do we respond to you know, volatile revenue sources that come that come with that. Now, when it comes to falling workforce participation levels, I mean, really, there are two things that we need to do at a high level in order to address that. We need to convince Australians to work longer so we can lift workforce participation by older Australians, and we have measures in the budget to incentivize that, and we also have to lift workforce participation by women. Now, when it comes to lifting workforce participation by women, there are two policy levers that are important. One, obviously, is affordable access to affordable, high-quality childcare, and the other is a fair dinkum paid parental leave arrangements, because the evidence is that if a woman in the workforce has a baby and continues to be paid at the same level while she's on leave after having had her baby, she does stay connected with the workforce more, and the likelihood of going back to work after having had a baby is increased. Now, I mean, this is the reason we know this is because this is something that is, fair dinkum paid parental leave arrangements are widely available across the public sector. I mean, if you are working in the public sector, if you're working for a number of big business organisations, you do get access to fair dinkum paid parental leave arrangement at a replacement wage. The businesses that can't afford to provide that benefit are small businesses. And so what happens to small businesses? If they have high-quality women employees and they think they're about to go to have a baby, a number of them are likely to start choosing or opting for a public sector or a bigger business employment opportunity. So that is an issue for small business. But beyond that, I mean, if the way, I mean, from our point of view, this is really the paid parental leave policy is part of our agenda to build a stronger economy. If we want to build a stronger economy, we've got to continue to lift population, continue to lift workforce participation, continue to lift productivity, and that will help us do that. Now, if we were to speak about annual leave or sick leave or long service leave, nobody would put the proposition to us that this should just be a welfare entitlement paid at the minimum wage by Centrelink. Everybody would say, well, no, of course, if I go on annual leave, I should be paid at my usual wage. Why is it so extraordinary to suggest, well, if a woman is having a baby, and she's going on leave for a six-month period after she's had that baby, why should she not be paid at her replacement wage, up to a point? And, of course, there are some limits around that you'd be well aware. Now, I mean, obviously, I mean, does that make it a bit more complicated, a bit more difficult for us to make the case? Well, sure, because we're not working in a perfect world, and the Labor Party will always throw things at us, because rather than to confront the fact that they're not putting forward a serious, credible, legitimate alternative plan to deal with the debt and deficit disaster they left behind, it's much easier to sort of just point at the paid parental leave scheme and then just walk away. The truth is, even if Labor were genuinely to reverse that policy after we have legislated it, it would not be enough to get the budget back to surplus, and it's just a smokescreen that Labor uses for political purposes.
There's a question here, then we go over there. Yep.
just on that.
That'd be quick.
Generally, the role of the opposition leader is he gets paid to come up with alternatives. And anyway, my question's GST. Ultimately, the distribution of it is up to the Commonwealth government, but the raising of that tax is by the states. Do you believe that it would be worthwhile to review the distribution of the GST from its current state?
Well, there's a methodology review in terms of GST sharing arrangements and the ordinary course of events that is taking place through the Commonwealth Grants Commission now, that is under existing and well-established processes that happens on a regular basis. In terms of the policy settings when it comes to the GST, I mean, you'd well remember that we made a very firm commitment in the lead-up to the last election that we would not make any changes to the GST, full stop, end of story. What we did say when it came to tax was that in our first term we would scrap the carbon tax and deliver income tax cuts or fund the income tax cuts without a carbon tax. We'd scrap the mining tax and deliver company tax cuts without a mining tax. And in terms of medium to long-term tax reform priorities, we would pursue that through a tax white paper review process. That process should get underway in the not-too-distant future. We would expect to have a green paper out by April next year and a white paper towards the end of the next calendar year, and then whatever recommendations out of that process we adopt as a government in terms of changes to our tax system to strengthen economic growth into the future, we would take to the next election, as we said we would do in the lead-up to the last election. So beyond the specific tax reform commitments that we made in the lead-up to the last election, anything beyond that would be part of a second-term agenda.
Question out the back, let me come over here. Yep, Ian.
Senator, thank you for your talk. I'd like to ask you a question, if I may, on a small part of your portfolio, which doesn't get a lot of attention, being corporate law. Another budget measure that didn't get much attention was the abolition of the Companies and Markets Advisory Committee, which, as you know, was doing close to concluding an important review of the future of the annual general meetings. Which seems to have disappeared without trace, involved in the Treasury. Has the government got any corporate law reform agenda, including anything on the future of annual general meetings?
Well, let me just make a general point about organisational matters across government and why it is that we pursued the winding down or the merger or abolition of a series of government bodies. When we came into government, nobody could tell us how many different government bodies there were. The initial advice was, well, I think about 700. And then we were told, no, well, probably more like 800. And then the National Commission of Audit identified 900, and as it turns out, like by final count, we were up to 1,000 different government bodies of smaller and larger sizes. And of course, every such body with a secretariat and with staff and corporate support, and essentially, and in particular, given the fiscal position we're in, and as part of our commitment to smaller, more efficient government, what we've said is, well, unless a particular function cannot be performed through one of the major public sector, if a function can be delivered through one of the major public sector departments, then that is where it should be done, rather than having a plethora of various bodies out there doing a series of very important bits and pieces all over the place. So what we've done so far is we've reduced the number of government bodies by what is not a big enough number yet, by 70. So out of 1,000, we've been able to reduce the number of government bodies by 70, and the committee you mentioned is one of those. Now, I mean, when it comes to policy in this space, I mean, obviously, there's at any one point in time, there are a whole range of discussion papers out in terms of corporate law reform to improve this, improve that. Our focus is on making sure that we have a robust but efficient regulatory system in place in which our economy is able to grow as strongly as possible. And whenever there are sensible proposals for reform, we'll consider them on their merits and make judgments on a case-by-case basis.
Yes, Senator, there seems to be some evidence that the economy is slowing. Do you have any comment on that idea? Does that make your job harder? And does that put an emphasis upon the need to look at whether you should take a slower return to surplus, because if you take a fast return to surplus in a slowing economy, you could make things worse?
The last reported quarter of national accounts actually showed stronger growth than expected. Not that we were getting ahead of ourselves in relation to any of that, but certainly the published data so far is not showing what you're suggesting. And certainly from our point of view, the budget we delivered, while it seeks to achieve an efficient fiscal consolidation, from our point of view, it is a growth budget. Yes, we did reduce government expenditure, but we also are getting rid of a whole series of taxes that are holding back our capacity to grow the economy. We're also making a record investment in productivity-enhancing infrastructure. One of the understated aspects of the budget, as well as reducing the total government spend, the remaining spend is now overall a higher quality spend. I mean, there has been quite a shift from recurrent expenditure to investment into growing the economy moving forward. I mean, our initiative to cut red tape will be our initiative to cut red tape will increase economic growth. And not every savings measure, incidentally, has a contractionary effect on the economy either. I mean, our decision to delay the increase in compulsory super to 12% means that individuals and small businesses will end up with more money in their pocket, and that will actually, be, to the extent that, these things play out in the economy, and these actually will add to economic growth rather than detract from economic growth. So, short answer is all up. Our budget, and I said this in my remarks, I mean, in our judgment, it is a sensible way to get back to surplus. I mean, we didn't rush to surplus within 5 minutes. I mean, we are taking a realistic and economically responsible pathway, but we don't think that we should delay it any further than what we're suggesting, because I mean, obviously, the longer we continue to borrow from our children and grandchildren, the higher the price we're asking them to pay for our cost of living with interest.
There's a question here. Pretty quick.
I'm interested to know why you don't use people like Kerry O'Dwyer, lively, intelligent young woman, and younger people to represent the Liberal government.
There's a question about Kerry O'Dwyer. But she does appear a lot on television.
Yeah, I think that Kerry O'Dwyer
is... on Sky News.
I think that Kerry O'Dwyer is outstanding. I love Kerry O'Dwyer. She's a very good friend, and she does do a lot of television, and you're right, she's a very effective advocate for our cause, and I'm sure that in the years to come, you will see more and more of Kerry O'Dwyer, so I agree with you.
So there's a question here.
Well, Minister, you paint quite a bleak picture of the government's financial position. like 200 billion, which is about 8,000 per household. And of course, households will have to repay the debt. It's not going to be a politician. But the situation, to me, seems to be much worse, because currently households in Australia owe 1.84 billion, which is about 80,000 per person. Now, I'm sure the government is aware of this, and the question is the government thinking about this?
Or okay, the question on the extent of household debt.
Well, as the Finance Minister of Australia, I focus on public sector debt at a federal level, and as you might have noticed with the way the debate has been going in recent weeks, that keeps me busy. Are we planning to do anything to contract private sector debt? No. I mean, obviously, the market is going to set the demand and supply for private sector credit. But when it comes to public sector debt, I mean, we should get out of the way of the private sector when it comes to borrowing in the market. I mean, just to make a private sector analogy to what the Australian government is doing right now, the Australian government right now is like a family that is putting a proportion of its grocery bill on its credit card every month, month after month, year in, year out, never paying it off, taking out a second credit card to pay the interest on the first, and then at the end of the parent's life, they hand the credit card over, accumulated over a number of years, to their kids and say, that's yours to deal with now. And that is what the Australian government is doing right now. That is the situation that we're wanting to fix at a federal level, and that is why we think it's so important for the government to get back to living within its means.
John?
Senator, thank you very much for an excellent presentation on the government's thrust in budget. I have a question. In your thinking, or in your desire to eliminate red and green tape, have you given any thought to removing and or extending the deadline for the ridiculous regulations that are about to apply to the visual arts and the investment therein by self-managed superannuation funds?
Well, obviously we're not in favour of ridiculous regulation. When it comes to the regulation you mentioned, I'm aware that the previous government made some changes after the Cooper review into superannuation. which were designed to ensure that people didn't abuse the capital available to them in their retirement savings for by investing it in items for personal use. Now, obviously, superannuation savings attract significant tax concessions, and the reason they attract significant tax concessions is to ensure that people are encouraged to save to get themselves in a position to fund their own retirement rather than having to rely on the age pension. And there is in the legislation what is called a sole purpose test, which means that in order to be able to get that tax benefit, you ought to deploy all of the savings and the earnings on those savings towards funding your retirement. Now, I mean, what did happen is that there was a growing market in relation to self-managed super funds investing in art, which was not deployed for the sole purpose of funding retirement, but which was deployed for, I guess, personal use while still contributing to the super fund. Now, look, I mean, I'm aware of the issue broadly. If there are any specific suggestions on how you know, the system can be made more efficient while preserving the integrity of the reason why there is a tax incentive in the first place, I'm very happy to have a conversation.
Final question. You ended up, as you know, in the Senate. And once upon a time, that was sort of regarded as a kind of gentleman's club, and later ladies were admitted. But in the current climate, is it like that? And, or to put it in a briefer, you know, what's it like these days to fly back to Perth with Senator Ludlam on the plane? How are you getting on with one another?
In the Senate, the debate can be robust, and that's okay. That's right. I mean, obviously, you know, it's where decisions about the future of the nation are made, and whether it was the previous government or this government, it's quite appropriate that our judgments and our decisions about a way forward are properly tested and scrutinised, and that we have to justify ourselves. From my point of view, I don't think that these matters are never personal, whether they're Labour senators, Green senators, Parliament United Party senators. I mean, they're all good people. I mean, you know, everybody. I mean, I haven't come across anyone yet where I'm of the view that you're not here for the right reason. I mean, I might disagree with people violently and fundamentally, but I've got to say, overwhelmingly, whatever the party you represent, overwhelmingly people are in the parliament to make a positive difference to our country. And obviously we're there to debate out the issues and make decisions about the best way forward. And we happen to think that our way is the best way forward, and we'll continue to make that argument. And hopefully we'll win more often than not.
Many thanks. This is super interesting. So many thanks to Senator Matthias Cormann. It's great to get the Finance Minister, a very busy Cabinet Minister, along to the Sydney Institute to talk about the budget just in the period before Parliament resumes. It was evident in the election period that Senator Cormann's one of the finest communicators in the opposition. We've seen that here again tonight. I think the explanation of the paid parental scheme is perhaps as good as I've heard tonight for why it's important. So we're very pleased you've come along tonight and spared us your time, taken half an hour questions and discussion. Good luck on Late Line tonight, and we know you'll be back here in the future, but for tonight, congratulations and thanks.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.